the nobility. And then the essential instability at the heart of English politics reared its head. And this was the questionable nature of the Lancastrian claim to the throne. While everything was going well, nobody wanted to make a big deal out of this. But when things were going badly, there was a ready-made way to challenge the king. You would claim that he wasn't rightfully the king. Now, we've seen in various struggles, going all the way back to the reign of King John, that the essential problem in English politics is, how do you get the king to behave the way you want him to behave? How do you constrain the king? All sorts of things had been tried against troublesome kings. Councils of various kinds, parliamentary measures. Already, in two cases, kings had finally had to be deposed because they just weren't responsive to the political will of the people. At least, the very small segment of the people whose opinions really mattered. But the deposition of Richard II and the accession of Henry Bolingbroke had given opponents of the king a good fallback option. They didn't even have to prove anymore that the king wasn't a good king. They could just get away with saying he wasn't the legitimate king. And that was a dangerous element to add into the mix in the 15th century. You already have a lot of nobles with too much power. They're deeply divided among themselves. The commons is eager for victory in France. They're frantic at seeing their tax money seemingly frittered away in the war without success. So there's a lot to worry about. We're going to see a lot of events, a lot of people. It's a lot to keep straight. So I'm going to divide this lecture into three main sections. First, we're going to look at the war in France and how things start to go wrong for the English there. Then we're going to look at the political struggles back in England. And we'll see that Henry VI's reign falls into two main phases. First, we see a struggle between two segments of the royal family, led by the king's uncle, Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester, on the one hand, and the king's great-uncle, Cardinal Beaufort, on the other. And then the leadership of these two factions changes hands, and we see the two factions led by Henry's queen, Margaret of Anjou, on the one hand, and by Richard, Duke of York, on the other. So first we're going to have a war, and then we're going to have two rounds of political infighting. So let's see how it all plays out. At first, after the death of Henry V, it looked as if things were going to be fine. Henry had several very competent close relatives who could rule on behalf of the young king. The Burgundian alliance was still in effect. The king's uncle, John, Duke of Bedford, was a very experienced military commander, and he actually gained territory in France throughout the 1420s. The Dauphin, Charles, the one who had been disinherited by the Treaty of Troyes, he was still in the field trying to fight back against the English, but despite the fact that his father, the king, had died, he died the same year as Henry V in 1422, the Dauphin has still not managed to get himself crowned King of France. And this is because the English controlled the city of Reims, and Reims was the traditional site for French royal coronations. Now, the Dauphin was not very popular with the French people because he seemed rather helpless against the English. And the French are not fans of the English at this point, and in fact, there's considerable ethnic hostility between the French and the English. The French at this point call the English soldiers les Godams, apparently because the English soldiers made frequent use of that particular profane oath. Well, by 1429, an English army under the command of the Duke of Suffolk is besieging Orléans, the last French royal stronghold. Once the English have Orléans, they're going to truly be able to claim that the dual monarchy of England and France is a reality. But it was not to be. It was just at this moment that a young French girl known as Joan of Arc heard voices telling her to aid the Dauphin in his struggle against the English. So Joan put on men's clothing and persuaded the reluctant Dauphin to let her lead troops into battle. And she marched on Orléans in May of 1429, relieved the siege, and captured Suffolk, the English commander. And her troops then beat another English force at Patay. And incidentally, one of the English commanders at that battle was Sir John Fastolf, our old friend from the past in letters. Now, this victory at Patay left the way clear for the French to march on Paris. But Joan wasn't just a brave warrior. She was also a very good public relations strategist. She knew the symbolic importance of coronation, and she figured that the French were going to be far more likely to fight for Charles if he were their anointed king. They had to get this guy crowned. So instead of heading for Paris, she convinced the Dauphin to go to Reims. And on July 17th, the Dauphin was solemnly crowned Charles VII of France. Now, the English have to make a comeback to this, and so the young Henry VI was also crowned King of France later that year, but in Paris. And that just doesn't cut the same ice with the French. It's got to be Reims. Now, there were some very important people at the coronation of Charles VII. There were representatives of the Duke of Burgundy. Now, this is a somewhat ominous sign for the future for England. The Dauphin, now the king, and the Duke of Burgundy are still enemies, but Burgundy is now starting to think it's going to be smart to hedge his bets a little bit. But for now, Burgundy is still firmly allied with the English, and in 1430, the Duke joins in decisively on the English side. The Burgundian army besieges the town of Compiègne in Champagne. Joan marches to relieve the siege, but at that point, she is captured by the Burgundians. And the Burgundians sell her to the English for 10,000 crowns. She's tried for heresy at Rouen in Normandy in 1431. Now, it's a political trial. There aren't really any grounds for thinking Joan was a heretic. And in fact, the records of the trial had to be doctored because the original version reflected very well on Joan. She was asked some very complicated theological questions, and she made some very canny answers. So the technical grounds on which she finally ends up getting executed have to do with men's clothes. She promises to stop wearing men's clothes, but when she was in prison, she had resumed male attire. Now, she probably did this to protect herself against assault in prison. She may have been molested at one point. We're not sure exactly why, but technically the fact that she put men's clothes back on allowed her to be treated as a relapsed heretic, and that allowed the English to burn her at the stake. So on May 30th of 1431, Joan was burned at the stake in the marketplace of Rouen. Now, at the time, an English soldier is said to have remarked that the English had just burned a saint. In fact, Joan wasn't formally canonized until 1909. But the English have now gotten rid of their great enemy, the Maid of Orléans. So far, so good. But it doesn't turn out to help them in the long run. In 1435, 4 years after Joan's death, the Duke of Bedford died, and the English never found a commander who really could replace him. Now, equally problematic for the English, if not more so, is the fact that in that same year, 1435, the two warring French royal factions made peace. And for the first time in decades, the English now face a united French front. And the odds are now decisively against the English, and they never shift back. It's really just a matter of time from this point on. Slowly, the English are pushed back towards the sea until by 1453, all that's left for them is the port city of Calais. Now, they would keep Calais for another century, but for all intents and purposes, the Hundred Years' War is effectively over, and the English had lost. And domestic matters are not going any better. And this is partly due to the fallout back in England of the disasters in France. At least in France, while Bedford is alive, the English command there is relatively united. Back at home, the English royal government is hopelessly divided between warring factions of the young king's relatives. Now, Henry VI himself is not a very promising candidate for the kingship. He never seems to have been completely sound in his mind. Later in his reign, he suffered from periodic bouts of complete insanity, no doubt inherited from his maternal grandfather, King Charles VI of France. And when he wasn't insane, he wasn't much help, because he was totally uninterested in affairs of state. He was a kind, gentle sort of man. He would have probably been far better off living a quiet, retired life. But the fact that you have this vacuum, basically, at the center of English political life means that there's tremendous competition to fill that vacuum. And that competition causes the instability of Henry's reign. Now, the instability has a rhythm to it. When the war in France is going well, things back in England go pretty well also, because a lot of the most troublesome nobles go off to France to try to win glory and get rich in the war. But after 1435, after the death of Bedford and the end of the Burgundian alliance, a lot of noble energy gets refocused on competition for power back in England. And the court basically is polarized into two camps. And a lot of what happens for the rest of Henry's reign is basically a series of attacks by one faction against another. It's not necessarily important to keep the details straight. The main point is simply that these people are very embittered against each other, and they're willing to use whatever weapons they can find to score points against each other. And I'll just give you some of the highlights. But first I'll explain who the main players are. One of the two factions is led by Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester, the last surviving full-blooded brother of Henry V. The other faction is led by Henry Beaufort, Bishop of Winchester and later Cardinal, and his numerous relatives. Now, the Beauforts are actually also closely related to the king. And here we have to go back for a minute to that very complicated genealogy of the English royal family. You'll remember John of Gaunt, Duke of Lancaster, the father of Henry Bolingbroke. Well, he had had a longtime mistress named Catherine Swynford, and he had several children by her, and eventually he married her. And their children were legitimized after the fact and known as the Beaufort family. And Henry Beaufort, the Bishop of Winchester, was one of these children of John of Gaunt and Catherine Swynford. So, wait for it, he's the half-great-uncle of Henry VI. And he's a very ambitious man. Now, Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester, of course, is also very ambitious. He's the brother of the dead king and uncle of the new king. He's the Lord Protector on behalf of his infant nephew. Now, Humphrey's probably the least capable of the four sons of Henry IV, at least in a military sense and a political sense. But he's a very cultivated man. He was well known as a collector of books. In fact, the rare books library at Oxford University is named Duke Humphrey's Library because Duke Humphrey donated a large collection of manuscripts to the university in the 1430s. But there's no love lost between the Beauforts and Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester. The Beauforts had tied up a lot of key positions at court. Henry Beaufort is chancellor. But Gloucester is still very powerful because he is Lord Protector of the king. So you have this balance of power, a very uneasy situation. And the two factions repeatedly clash in the 1420s. For example, over Flemish trade. Gloucester backed a tax break for native merchants against Flemish merchants. Beaufort wanted to keep the two tax rates the same. Now, this dispute ends up spilling over into the streets of London. And peace is only finally restored in 1426 at a parliament called in Leicester. London is too unsettled at the time for the parliament to be held there. They have to move to Leicester. And this session of parliament became known as the Parliament of Bats. And this is because Gloucester, the Lord Protector, in an effort to try to prevent violence, bans the carrying of swords into the parliament chamber. So instead of swords, people bring in clubs or bats or whatever they can get. It's not Parliament's finest hour, and it ends up with Beaufort resigning the chancellorship. But he is by no means finished as a political force. Gloucester, though, still wants to get rid of him. So in 1431, when Beaufort is temporarily away in France, Gloucester takes advantage of his absence to charge Beaufort with violating the Statute of Praemunire. Now, we have to remind ourselves what the Statute of Praemunire was. It was a law passed back in 1353 to regulate appeals of ecclesiastical cases to the Roman Curia. Beaufort had just been made a cardinal. Gloucester is claiming that the position of cardinal is incompatible with Beaufort's other job as Bishop of Winchester. He's trying to nail Beaufort under these rather arcane provisions of the Statute of Praemunire. But Beaufort is a smart politician. He enlists the commons on his side, and he gets the commons specifically to authorize him holding both ecclesiastical jobs at once. So they're using Parliament to score points off against each other in these very arcane power struggles. Now, we don't need to go into more detail here about this rivalry. It's certainly nasty, but periodically, Gloucester's brother Bedford would come back from France, and he would make the warring factions see sense. But when he died in 1435, everything got worse. Now, Gloucester doesn't have his popular brother, Bedford, the French war hero, to protect him. Beaufort gets more and more powerful. And finally, in 1441, he humiliates Gloucester. He accuses Gloucester's second wife, Eleanor, of witchcraft. Apparently, there had been some sort of plot to kill the king by sorcery, and one of the accused implicated Duchess Eleanor of Gloucester. Now, Eleanor did admit to dabbling in sorcery. Apparently, she had tried to obtain a love potion that would win her husband's love. But she flatly denied trying to use magic to kill the king. But she was given a very severe sentence. She had to walk through the streets of London holding a taper in her hand, a candle. And she had to offer this candle at three important London churches. And she had to do this three times on the next three market days in the city. It would be a very public, humiliating event. And after that, she was to be imprisoned for the rest of her life. Now, the whole thing is political. It's just like the way Joan of Arc was accused of heresy and witchcraft to get her out of the way. And the man behind this ingenious, rather sordid plot to discredit the Gloucesters is a new man on the scene in the Beaufort faction, William de la Pole, later Duke of Suffolk. He's the grandson of the Michael de la Pole, who had been driven into exile by the Lords Appellant during Richard II's reign. Same family. Now, increasingly, Suffolk took over the reins of government from Beaufort, who was getting older. And Suffolk was responsible for one of the most controversial diplomatic maneuvers of the whole Middle Ages. In 1445, he arranged the marriage of King Henry VI to a French princess named Margaret of Anjou. And under the terms of the agreement, the English had to cede the counties of Maine and Anjou to the French. Now, Suffolk is willing to trade away these territories because the new queen wants this very much. They will be going back to her father, René of Anjou. He was the titular Duke of Anjou. He had a hereditary claim on Anjou. So getting these lands meant a great deal to him and his family. And Suffolk felt that getting influence with the queen was worth paying this price. But it was a miscalculation. As soon as it became public knowledge that the English were going to give all these lands back to the French, there was a firestorm of criticism, and it all was laid at Suffolk's door. Now, Suffolk felt he had to defend himself, and so he moved against his most dangerous opponent, Gloucester. Gloucester had always been a hawk on the war. He was particularly angered by this decision to give Maine and Anjou back to the French without even striking a blow. And Suffolk was worried that Gloucester was going to cause problems. So in the spring of 1447, Suffolk arranged to have Parliament held in Bury St. Edmunds, in Suffolk, his own stronghold, his own neck of the woods, rather than in London, because in London, Gloucester had always been popular. Now, when Gloucester appeared at Parliament in Bury, he was arrested. Suffolk was planning to bring a trumped-up charge of treason against him. But Gloucester died in captivity within a week, probably of a heart attack brought on by the stress of the arrest. The aged Cardinal Beaufort also died within a few weeks of Gloucester. So we see one set of embittered opponents pass from the scene. But a new set of opponents is about to appear, because Suffolk's ascendancy really marks the beginning of phase two of the domestic rivalries that I want to talk about in this lecture. In fact, I think it's a sign of just how bad things are in English politics that you just get these enmities perpetuated. Same story, different people. The court by this point is permanently polarized, and King Henry is pretty much helpless to do anything about it. And I think this tells us how important royal leadership really is in England. If you don't have solid royal leadership, the government just doesn't function properly. So who are these two new players? They end up being the leaders of the two factions that are going to fight the Wars of the Roses, as we now call them. Nobody called them that then. The term wasn't invented until the 19th century. And obviously the war didn't have anything to do with actual roses. It came from the roses that were used on the badges of the two families that fought the war. The red rose of the House of Lancaster and the white rose of the House of York. But they didn't even really use these badges all the time. Still, it helps us to keep them straight, so we'll use the roses whenever we can. I'm going to have to go into some detail about genealogy here, so be warned. Here are our principles. The leader of the House of Lancaster, which is the royal house at this point, is not really King Henry VI. It's his wife, Queen Margaret. Margaret is the niece of the King of France, and it's her marriage to Henry that leads the English to give Maine and Anjou back to the French. Now, Margaret is a very determined woman. Shakespeare wrote three plays about Henry VI's reign, and Margaret is by far the strongest, most memorable character in these three plays. And she even shows up in Shakespeare's play Richard III after she's dead. And this is one instance, I think, where Shakespeare is not exaggerating. He calls her the she-wolf of France, and I think that fits. Margaret, though, is saddled with a husband who isn't really up to very much. So she's going to have to make the most of her opportunities for herself. And she is just as ruthless as any of the other actors on the political stage at this period. So she is really the head of the House of Lancaster, the Red Rose, but she has very able assistance from Suffolk and from the surviving members of the Beaufort family. So where do we get the House of York from, the White Rose? And this is where we really do have to resort very heavily to the genealogy. You'll remember the Earl of March. He had been the rightful heir at the time when Richard II was deposed, but Henry Bolingbroke took the throne as Henry IV instead. Well, the Earl of March died without heirs, but he had a sister, Anne Mortimer, who married Richard Earl of Cambridge, who happened to be one of the traitors who tried to assassinate Henry V before he went off to fight at Agincourt. Now, Richard Earl of Cambridge, the traitor, was the second son of Edmund of Langley, Duke of York, who was a son of Edward III. So you have Anne Mortimer, who descends from Edward III's son, Lionel, Duke of Clarence, and she marries Richard Earl of Cambridge, who descends from Edward III's son, Edmund of Langley, Duke of York. So they both descend from sons of Edward III. And since Richard Earl of Cambridge's brother died without heirs, Richard transmits a claim to the Duchy of York. So, when Anne Mortimer and Richard Earl of Cambridge have a son, he is going to have a claim to the Duchy of York from his father, and in fact, he will be known as Richard Duke of York. But, this is what really matters, Richard Duke of York also has a claim through his mother to the crown itself. He represents that legitimate line that was shunted aside at the time of the usurpation by Henry Bolingbroke. Now, for the moment, this is purely a theoretical claim. No one is advancing it yet. But it's out there. It's like a ticking time bomb. It's waiting for the right political circumstances to make it go off. Let's see how that happens. Now, Richard Duke of York had had a long career in the French War, like many other English noblemen. In fact, he had risen to command of the English forces in France. But then along came the peace treaty we talked about that ceded Maine and Anjou to the French. And York felt that this treaty had undermined his position in France, so he becomes the leader of the pro-war faction. Now, of course, Queen Margaret supports the treaty that Suffolk had negotiated, and she becomes the leader of the pro-peace faction. So the court is polarized. And in an effort to try to get rid of York, he is recalled from his command in Normandy and sent off to Ireland as Lord Lieutenant, and he's given the unusually long term of office of 10 years. And the idea is clearly, get him out of the way. What mischief could he get up to in Ireland? Surely he's just going to be swallowed up by all of the various problems there and never be heard from again. And we'll leave him there for just a moment because I want to make a brief digression here to talk about a revolt that took place in England in 1450. But we'll see that the faction fight at court is related to the revolt. And the revolt turns out to be the second most serious rebellion of this period after the Great Peasants' Revolt of 1381. Now, the rebels came from a slightly different social class than in 1381. They were minor gentry and yeomen, really people on the borderline between the people with property and the less well-off. And they came from the counties right around London, and they were led by a man named Jack Cade. Cade was a critic of the Lancastrian government, of the royal regime of Henry VI. He drew up a list of demands, and they boiled down to a desire to have the royal government just work better, have a better foreign policy that is successful and more cost-effective. And I think these are goals most people at the time could agree on. First, Cade wanted the king to stop giving away royal land to reward his favorites. He said, this is making the king poor, and thus he has to ask us for more taxes. The second thing is, Cade complained that members of parliament were not being elected freely. So he thinks that the integrity of the parliamentary process is being interfered with, and he obviously thus has a stake in the system working properly. And he's clearly pro-war. He wants a return to the aggressive stance that the English had taken at the time of Agincourt. That's the third of his demands. According to Cade, the current policy, as seen in the peace treaty, is a betrayal of the Agincourt legacy. But the last of Cade's demands is the most explosive. Cade demands that Richard, Duke of York, be added to the royal council. Now remember, York at this point has been sent off to exile, basically, in Ireland. Cade wants York back because he's pro-war. But this is a dangerous sign for the Lancastrians because, of course, York is the legitimate claimant to the English throne, at least by some people's reckoning. Now, the revolt doesn't amount to much militarily when all is said and done, but it does lead to one of the most memorable lines in Shakespeare, though it's not from one of his most memorable plays. Jack Cade's rebellion shows up in the play Henry VI, Part 2, and we see Cade, at one point, talking to his confederate, Dick, about the great things they're going to accomplish in the revolt. And Dick comes out with a plan that very much echoes one of the currents we saw in the Peasants' Revolt of 1381, hostility to the law. So Dick says to Cade, "The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers!" Now, this line inevitably provokes cheers and applause in a modern audience. I'm sure it did in Shakespeare's time as well, though then as now, there are likely to have been quite a few lawyers in the audience. Now, this is a true story. I once went to see a performance in Washington of the three Henry VI plays that were condensed down into a single evening version. And it happened to be Lawyer's Night at the theater. The Lawyers Guild that supports the theater all came out on that night to see the play. And they had a special surprise guest star to deliver that immortal line about killing all the lawyers. It was Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was a big supporter of the theater. So she gets out there and she says, "The first thing we do, we kill all the lawyers." And as soon as people in the audience realized who it was, dressed up as Dick, the theater erupted into even greater applause than usual. But let's get back to the revolt itself. Cade was captured, he was executed, along with his confederates. But the fact that he had called for York to be put back at the center of affairs, that news made its way to Ireland. And it encouraged York to come back to England and demand to be given what he considered to be his rightful place in government. And from this point on, conflict between York and the royal government became inevitable. And you can really see the creation of these two factions, the Yorkist Party and the Lancastrian Party. Now, at first, York is content to bide his time, because King Henry VI so far has failed to produce an heir. He's been married to Queen Margaret for nearly a decade, but so far no children. That means that Richard, Duke of York, is the heir apparent. He would technically stand to inherit the throne when Henry VI died. He could just wait. But then in 1453, two things happened. Queen Margaret at last gave birth to a son, who was named Edward, and Henry VI suffered the first of a series of serious bouts of insanity. So York has been displaced from the succession by the birth of the king's son, and the king's insanity means that the royal government is going to be even more under the direct control of the faction led by Queen Margaret. Richard, Duke of York, is going to have to assert his claim to the throne if he is going to matter in English politics. And that means there's going to be war. And we'll find out what happened next in the next lecture.
Lecture 34, The Wars of the Roses.
Welcome back. In our last lecture, we looked at the reign of Henry VI down to the 1450s, and it was not a very happy story. We saw England losing territory in France thanks to Joan of Arc and also due to the marriage alliance between Henry VI and Queen Margaret of Anjou. And we saw chronic political instability at home. The court is divided into two factions. And by 1453, there is a deep polarization between these two factions. Now, who are they? One is the Royal or Lancastrian faction, led by Queen Margaret, with her allies, the Earl of Suffolk and the Beaufort family. The other faction is the Yorkist faction, led by Richard, Duke of York, and he has a very powerful claim to the English throne. And we saw that once King Henry VI and Queen Margaret produced an heir in 1453, conflict between the two factions is practically inevitable, because now Richard, Duke of York, is faced with a choice, either to accept being marginalized or claim the throne. And in this lecture, we're going to see what happened when he made the fateful decision to claim the English throne. And that claim led directly to what we call the Wars of the Roses, the Red Rose of Lancaster against the White Rose of York. So we're going to cover the battles in this lecture, and there are a lot of them, but we're really going to only dwell on the highlights, the battles that turn the tide in one direction or another. Even then, there are a lot of battles. We'll see that over the course of the Wars of the Roses, the momentum shifts back and forth between York and Lancaster a number of times. But here's the main trajectory. First, there's a period in the 1450s when the two sides are battling it out inconclusively. Second, in 1461, the Yorkists are victorious, and they take the throne for 10 years. Third, the Lancastrians make a brief comeback in 1471, but then they're driven off the throne again. And finally, in 1485, the Lancastrians are victorious for good, though their family will have a new name by then, the Tudors. So we're going to cover most of the first three phases of the wars in this lecture. And then we're going to look at the last phase, the very eventful reign of the last Yorkist king, Richard III, that led to the Tudor takeover. We'll look at that in the next lecture. So let's plunge in. As I said, once there is an heir to the throne, young Prince Edward, that means Richard, Duke of York, is not in the direct line of succession anymore. But at first he's hesitant to claim the throne. That would be risky. And he decides that his best strategy for now is simply to insist on his right to advise the king. And this is a very traditional rebel demand. English barons have been making it for centuries. And he has the means to insist on this. He has a huge military retinue, just like lots of other important nobles in this period. And the king doesn't really have many more soldiers than the duke does. Both sides also need to recruit other nobles and their large retinues. So in a military sense, these two factions are not really that unequal. Well, the first set piece battle between the main opponents in the conflict took place in May of 1455 at the Battle of St. Albans, just outside of London. And it's a victory for the Yorkists. Two of the most important Lancastrian commanders were killed, and York was able to insist on being made protector of the king. He has to be protector because the king has once again lapsed into insanity. And so York is going to rule essentially in his stead. And for now, that's essentially as good as being king. But then, unfortunately for York, the king recovered his wits, such as they were. And so, from 1456 to 1459, once again York is marginalized, and he went back to Ireland, where he was still officially Lord Lieutenant, to rally support. And when he felt strong enough, in 1459, he briefly returned to England, but his forces were defeated at the Battle of Ludford. Now, interestingly, one big factor in the Yorkists' defeat at Ludford is the fact that King Henry was there in person at the head of the royal army. Now, he's not much of a military threat himself. He's not calling the shots in the battle. But his symbolic value is huge. And the Yorkists knew this. They want to attract supporters. So they tried to convince people that the king wasn't actually there with the royal army. They actually said he was dead. The Yorkists held masses for the soul of the king to try to convince people he was dead. But it didn't help. People did not buy it. It's still a big deal to attack the anointed king. A lot of people just didn't want to do it. And that meant the Yorkists were outnumbered. And York had to flee back to Ireland again. And his oldest son, Edward, Earl of March, took refuge in Calais. But in 1460, York made a much more concerted effort. And he had a very staunch ally, a man named Richard Neville, Earl of Warwick. The Neville family was very powerful in the north of England, and York was actually married to the Earl of Warwick's aunt, so there's a close family tie. Now, Warwick brought York's oldest son, Edward, Earl of March, back to England from Calais, and they captured King Henry VI at Northampton. So now the Yorkists control the king. And this allowed Richard, Duke of York, to appear in Parliament to claim the throne at last. But Parliament resisted the claim. They were reluctant to depose the king. The Lancastrian faction was just too strong. York had to be content with a compromise. He would get to be protector of the king during the king's lifetime, and then he would have the right to succeed him. So this compromise is actually going to disinherit the young son of Henry VI, Prince Edward. The Yorkists have enough leverage for that. They've got the king in captivity. But that's as far as Parliament wants to go. I think they're worried about causing any more questions about the legitimacy of royal rule that hadn't been working so well in recent decades. But York is not satisfied. He decides to try to destroy the last royal army still in the field. And this was his fatal mistake. For at the Battle of Wakefield, in December of 1460, the Yorkists suffered a major defeat, and Richard, Duke of York, was killed. The standard-bearer of the Yorkist faction was dead. And the Yorkists suffered a further blow. Queen Margaret managed to free her husband, the king, from captivity at the Second Battle of St. Albans in February of 1461. But the Earl of Warwick, Richard Neville, is still around, and he is still an ambitious man. Now is when he really earns his later nickname, the Kingmaker. York's son, Edward, Earl of March, who has now succeeded his dead father as Duke of York, takes up the Yorkist banner, and Warwick is right there by his side to advise him. And together, they take on the Lancastrians at the Battle of Towton in Yorkshire. And it turns out to be the bloodiest battle of the war, possibly the bloodiest ever fought on English soil. The armies fought on March 29th, 1461. It was Palm Sunday, but it was bitterly cold and snowing. It was snowing hard. The Yorkists had to advance uphill against the Lancastrian position. Now, often this can be disastrous. We've seen that in many of the English victories during the Hundred Years' War. But in this case, the weather was a huge help. The wind was at the Yorkists' backs. And this meant two things. First, the Yorkist archers can outrange the Lancastrian archers. Their arrows go farther. And second, the snow is blowing right into the faces of the Lancastrian soldiers. And this allows the Yorkists to close easily with their opponents, and then there is bitter hand-to-hand fighting. And finally, the Lancastrians broke and ran. And apparently, more soldiers died in the rout than in the actual battle. Several bridges collapsed as soldiers pressed across them trying to get away. And the soldiers were then plunged into the icy water below. It was a very bitter struggle. Civil conflicts often are. It's said that both sides had sworn to give no quarter. And that was rather unusual in this period. And the result of the battle is that King Henry and Queen Margaret have to flee to Scotland, and Parliament formally deposed Henry VI. They don't have much of a choice at this point. And young Edward claimed the throne as Edward IV. Edward had finally accomplished what his father, the Duke of York, had spent the better part of a decade trying to achieve. So now we have the Yorkist line on the throne, and Edward spent the next few years consolidating his rule, with Warwick's help, of course, and also with the help of his two brothers, George, Duke of Clarence, and Richard, Duke of Gloucester. And by 1464, the new king has managed to seize all of the remaining Lancastrian strongholds. And then in 1465, Edward has an enormous stroke of good luck. The ex-king, Henry VI, has spent some of the time since the Battle of Towton on the run in the north of England, but now he was captured and imprisoned in the Tower of London. So for the moment, the Lancastrian threat is neutralized. Now, of course, Queen Margaret is still at large, and she's by far the more dangerous of the two, but for the moment, she is biding her time. Now, the biggest problem that Edward has as king is the fact that he's so dependent on his noble backers, the people who had staked everything to bring about the change of dynasty, especially Warwick the Kingmaker. Without Warwick's men and his network of noble allies, Edward would never have become king, and Warwick was very conscious of that fact. But unfortunately, Edward seems to have forgotten it on one very crucial occasion. In the fall of 1464, Warwick was in the process of negotiating a French marriage alliance for the king. And the negotiations were at a very advanced stage when the king suddenly revealed that he was, in fact, already married. He had contracted a marriage in secret the previous May. The bride was a relatively obscure widow named Elizabeth Woodville. To make matters worse, she was from a Lancastrian family. But apparently the two had met, she had had something the king wanted, and she had the wit and the will to insist on a formal marriage before she gave it to him, even though it was contracted in secret. Now, Elizabeth Woodville was a beautiful woman, everybody acknowledged that, but she was also a very controversial figure because she brought to court with her a host of relatives. By birth, by marriage, she had a couple of sons from her first marriage, all of whom needed to be provided for. So once again, we have the problem of patronage rearing its head. And the Woodville faction at court is going to cause great instability down the road. Now, the revelation of this marriage was devastating to Warwick. To the French, it made him look either like he didn't know what he was doing or that he was trying to deceive them. And this was deeply humiliating to him, and it was probably the origin of Warwick's alienation from the king. And it didn't help that the king found rich marriages to endow all of his wife's relatives, but he wouldn't do anything in particular for Warwick's own two daughters. Warwick had no son, so these daughters were his main hope. Now, Warwick wanted his two daughters to marry the king's two brothers, George, Duke of Clarence, and Richard, Duke of Gloucester, but the king said no. And Warwick must have felt as if he had been very unfairly rewarded for his help in making Edward king. Now, in the summer of 1469, the split between Warwick and the king came out into the open, and ultimately it led to a brief revival of the Lancastrian cause. Warwick fomented a rebellion in the north of England, led by a shadowy figure who called himself Robin of Reedsdale. Now, this is probably a pseudonym for one of Warwick's own supporters. And before I describe the rebellion, I want to finally fulfill a promise made at the very beginning of the course. I want to explain why somebody would choose the name Robin under which to rebel. We've come at last to Robin Hood. Now, in some ways, we know much less about Robin Hood than we do about King Arthur. We can't even point to one specific time and place when stories began to circulate about Robin Hood. Scholars aren't even sure if these stories are ancient mythological tales or if they originally came about surrounding a specific person. There are scattered references to people with names similar to Robin Hood in royal judicial records all the way back to the 13th century. But Robin was a very common name at that time. It was the nickname for Robert, which was one of the most popular first names. Hood was a very common last name, so whether any of these people was the original Robin Hood is impossible to say. And this is made worse by the fact that Robin Hood became a kind of catch-all nickname for outlaws generally. So we don't even know if the people referred to in these records were really named Robin Hood or whether they were just being called that as a kind of job description because they were notorious criminals. We do know that there were songs about Robin Hood by at least the late 14th century. They're mentioned in Piers Plowman. But we don't have a complete Robin Hood ballad until the early 15th century, and it's called Robin Hood and the Monk. Now, in these ballads, Robin Hood is a yeoman. That's a relatively prosperous farmer. He's an excellent archer, but he's an outlaw, usually living in the forest, surrounded by a colorful cast of followers, and these would later become the Merry Men. In his adventures, Robin Hood usually manages some sort of daring escape from a legal predicament, like being imprisoned in the sheriff's prison. Now, the time when the stories are supposedly taking place isn't clear. Some ballads mention a King Edward, so that could be anywhere from the late 13th to the late 14th century, certainly not during the reign of Richard the Lionheart. That was something that people later decided it was going to be Richard the Lionheart's reign. But the precise date doesn't seem to make much difference in the stories. We also don't see Maid Marian and Friar Tuck yet. They arrive after our period. But you do see Little John and Will Scarlet, who become two of the most important merry men. They're already part of the tradition in the 15th century. And we also do see Robin Hood helping people in financial distress. We don't yet quite have the formula that Robin Hood robs from the rich so he can give to the poor. That's going to come later. But there's definitely the idea that Robin Hood takes the law into his own hands to do justice. Now, the most important thing about these stories is that they are outlaw adventures. And you get a lot of the same traditions attached to Robin Hood that we saw earlier attached to Hereward the Wake at the time of the Norman Conquest. There's something appealing about this figure who outwits the powers that be. And Robin Hood is enormously appealing. He is personally virtuous, and yet he's able to slip through the net of the law. And that's the legacy that this rebel is appealing to. In 1469, when he calls himself Robin of Reedsdale, he's casting himself as this virtuous but defiant figure. He's calling the authorities to task. So Robin of Reedsdale, or whoever he is, he publishes a manifesto listing demands. And these are very similar to Jack Cade's demands from the rebellion in 1450, only this time they're now directed against the Yorkist government. Now, these are probably ghost-written by Warwick. Warwick is probably trying to create a popular outcry against King Edward, maybe with a view to getting rid of the king altogether. But it's very interesting that he is appealing to the public. Now, because Warwick the Kingmaker now has a new candidate for the throne, what he thinks might be able to control, he might be able to control this new one a bit better than he had been able to control Edward IV. His new candidate is Edward's younger brother, George, Duke of Clarence. In July of 1469, Warwick secretly married his daughter Isabel to the Duke of Clarence in Calais. Now remember, the king had already denied permission for this marriage. Probably, Clarence agreed to the marriage with the understanding that his new father-in-law would install him on the throne in place of his brother. Now, Warwick then crossed to England from Calais and captured King Edward. He executed the queen's father and brother as traitors. These are the Woodvilles. And he is thus prosecuting this feud against the Woodvilles, who have blocked his way to patronage. But kingmaking didn't prove as easy this time. disorder spread. It was too dangerous to call a parliament to ratify Edward's deposition. And by this point, you have to do that. If you want to get rid of the king, you've got to get parliament's okay. And Warwick found that he couldn't rule without Edward's authority as anointed king. And so he had no choice but to release Edward from captivity. But of course, Warwick now knows that he has permanently lost the king's trust. So in the following year, in 1470, he and his son-in-law Clarence fled the country and they took refuge with the king of France, Louis XI. Now, of course, the French kings are going to be supporters of the Lancastrians, because Queen Margaret, the wife of Henry VI, is a French princess. So King Louis of France offered to help Warwick, but only if he would help put Henry VI back on the throne of England. Now, the Earl of Warwick has already created one Yorkist king. He has already tried to replace him with another Yorkist king. Now, he changes sides entirely and becomes a Lancastrian. He agrees to work for the restoration of Henry VI to the throne. And this meant allying with Queen Margaret. Now, I don't think either Warwick or Margaret relished this idea. But the King of France is the one paying for all this, and that was his price for supporting them. So, Warwick and Queen Margaret became allies. And to cement the alliance, Warwick married his second daughter, Anne, to Margaret's son Edward, the Prince of Wales. Now, Warwick gathered allies with the help of his French money and landed in England in the fall of 1470. And he quickly managed to drive Edward into exile in the Low Countries. Edward's queen, Elizabeth Woodville, took refuge in Westminster Abbey. This is a sanctuary that you couldn't violate without causing a very serious backlash in public opinion. Warwick then engineered the restoration of Henry VI to the throne. He's a kingmaker again. And this period, when Henry is back on the throne, is known as the re-adeption. And that really just means restoration. But Warwick had reckoned without his other son-in-law. Remember him, the one Warwick rebelled for the first time. That's Clarence. And Clarence was not very happy when Warwick became a Lancastrian, because now obviously the whole plan of putting Clarence on the throne has disappeared from view. Clarence doesn't see any point anymore in maintaining the alliance with Warwick. He figured he'd do better crawling back to his brother Edward, the ex-king. So that's what he did. And the York brothers somehow made up their quarrel and plotted to get back to England to get rid of Warwick and his new Lancastrian allies. Now, foreign money is very important throughout all of these very complicated maneuvers. We've already seen that French money was crucial to getting the Lancastrians back into power. Now, Edward went for help to the Duke of Burgundy. And the fact is that the continental powers are using this power struggle for their own purposes. France and Burgundy are at odds with each other again by now, and each wants an alliance with the English. And each is prepared to shell out to support whichever claimant to the English throne is most likely to help them in their struggle against each other. And just as French money is enough to get Henry VI back on the throne, Burgundian money is enough to put Edward IV back on the throne. So in March of 1471, Edward lands in England. And on April 14th, Edward goes up against Warwick at the Battle of Barnet, just north of London. And Warwick is killed. He had tried to make a king one time too many. On the very same day, Queen Margaret and her only son Edward, the Prince of Wales, who's now 18, land at Weymouth and move west. They're going to try to meet up with a crucial ally from Wales, Jasper Tudor. He's the uncle of Henry Tudor, about whom we're going to have a lot more to say in the next lecture. But before Margaret could get to the rendezvous, King Edward caught up with her at Tewkesbury in Gloucestershire. And the battle was a Yorkist triumph. The Lancastrian commander, Somerset, just didn't have the tactical skill that King Edward had. Edward's brother, Richard of Gloucester, led a successful flanking maneuver. Edward used a detachment of mounted spearmen who ambushed the Lancastrians from the rear. And the slaughter was extensive enough that one part of the battlefield became known as the Bloody Meadow. Although it has to be said that a lot of battlefields have a spot called the Bloody Meadow. That seems almost to come with the territory. Now, it was obviously very significant that the Lancastrian army never was allowed to meet up with Jasper Tudor. But in a lot of ways, the most important single outcome of the battle was the fact that Edward, Prince of Wales, the Lancastrian heir, did not survive it. He was captured by George, Duke of Clarence, and executed on the spot. Queen Margaret was captured too, but it almost didn't matter because her dynastic hopes died with her son. And in fact, as soon as Edward IV is properly restored to the throne by Parliament, King Henry VI was quietly murdered in the Tower of London. Edward didn't want any more Lancastrian re-adeptions. It was given out that Henry had died of a broken heart, which would have been very understandable under the circumstances, and he was widely mourned. He hadn't been an effective king, far from it, but people thought of him as a pious, simple soul, and there was considerable sympathy for him among the public. But with Henry, the Lancastrian cause seemed to have been buried for good. There didn't seem to be any plausible claimant to replace the dead Prince of Wales. So now Edward IV is back on the throne, and his second period of rule proved to be the most successful England had enjoyed since the brief reign of Henry V. Edward made progress in the areas of foreign policy, finance, public order. Unlike Henry V, though, Edward basically turned his back on warfare. He'd had enough fighting, I think, during the struggles over the throne, and he concentrated on more peaceful pursuits and on enjoying life as king, which he did. And to make sure he could do this, he concluded a peace treaty with France in 1475, the Treaty of Picquigny. And this ended a lot of economic uncertainty about trade. And in fact, there was a big trade boom. Edward also took steps to shore up the royal finances, and he especially worked hard to avoid asking Parliament for taxes. Everybody knew that that's when kings got in trouble. So he confiscated the estates of the defeated Lancastrians. That brought in considerable resources for the crown. He also demanded payments directly from supposedly grateful subjects. And these were officially known as benevolences, because supposedly they were offered out of goodwill. Really, people don't have much of a choice about it. But England was glad to have peace and order at last, so people paid. And as a result, Edward is the first king since Henry II in the 12th century not to die in debt. Edward also made progress with regard to public order. He rather ruthlessly shut the magnates out of his inner court circle. He relied instead on functionaries who he could control rather easily, and this damped down some of the faction fighting that had been rampant in English politics for the better part of a century. Edward also attacked the problem of disorder in the north of England for the first time in a very long time. He installed his brother Richard, Duke of Gloucester, as king's lieutenant in the north, and Richard made a great success of the post. He was well-liked in the north, and he was effective at keeping the very fractious northern nobles in check. The only serious threat to Edward's rule came in 1477 from his own brother Clarence. Clarence was angry that Edward refused to let him marry the heiress to the Duchy of Burgundy. By this point, Clarence's first wife had died, so once again, marriage is causing trouble between the brothers. Now, when a plot by Clarence was revealed, Edward had him imprisoned in the Tower of London and attainted as a traitor by Parliament. And Parliament actually clamored for his execution. Clarence was killed in the Tower of London in 1478, though the means are unclear. Now, Shakespeare has him drowned in a butt of Malmsey wine. And this might be a distortion of an actual fact about Clarence's burial, a kind of a folk memory. His body was sent to be buried at Tewkesbury Abbey, and it's just possible that his body was preserved in a barrel of Malmsey wine. This sort of thing was done occasionally to preserve a body that had to be transported a long distance for burial. We never know for sure, but the fact is that King Edward had not scrupled to remove his feckless brother. He was determined to have peace at last. And mainly, it seems, Edward wanted peace so he could have a good time. He liked eating rather more than was good for his health, and he also enjoyed the company of ladies other than the Queen. And in fact, his early death at the age of 40 was widely attributed to overindulgence. When he died, he left a young and numerous family with the very formidable task of consolidating the Yorkist ascendancy. But before we take up that story in the next lecture, I want to talk a little about one of the key centers of Yorkist power, namely London. It was small by modern standards, but it was by far the largest city in England. It had about 50,000 inhabitants.